I will on Friday or so on again pause for questions. Some of you have questions. So we can do it this Friday or we can simply do it the last class. And that is to which we come today and which I have cut down to the bone, namely only to two lectures or so. And I cut it down for several reasons. One reason is that we do enough reading about it so that it might be more profitable in the end to see what questions you have about it. But secondly also, when you do your reading about it, also in the culture of Western Europe, it becomes clear that fascism will sum up a great deal of what we have dealt with. And that very quality of fascism, to sum up so much of the previous culture, is in fact extremely important. For perhaps I can put it this way at the beginning, that fascism is in fact the climax of the kind of cultural change that we have been concerned with from the beginning of this term, more than any other, really. The cultural change that I have called the anti-bourgeois or bourgeois revolution. And if you look at all the things that you've studied from the expressionism and futurism onward, which had definite affinities towards fascism, even in a way to the Bauhaus, as I said, and parts of Weimar culture, it becomes clear to you perhaps, inasmuch as these were a quest for change, not for social and economic change, but for a change of culture, for a change, if you like, as the fascists called it, a change of the spirit, a change of culture. Inasmuch as we've seen all of this, it is obviously a background, and it feeds obviously into fascism, and it summarizes it. But it summarizes it in an odd fashion. Not so much Italian fascism itself, for Italian fascism was broader based. Italian fascism, the nationalism was in a sense diluted by trade union influences, by leftist syndicalist influences, which were missing in Germany. But in Germany, as you read Nazi culture, you will see all the time that this kind of urge for change and fundamental change is always related to culture. That there is no doubt that fascism is so relatively summarizing of all we have done, because what counts in fascism, as it saw itself and as others saw it, was what we might call the primacy of culture. That fascism presented itself really as a continuation of an urge towards change based on two things, really. The revolt of the end of the century, which we studied so much from Wedekind to anything else, and second of all, the First World War. But from that point of view, from both the revolt of youth of the end of the century and the First World War, which I've talked about after on some length, precisely for this purpose. You have, therefore, the idea of myth and symbol. You have the idea of mass movements, after I told you that Hitler and Mussolini were influenced by Le Bon, probably more than by any other factor in their politics. That they took their politics from Le Bon more than anything else. And they were influenced vitally by the youth cult of the end of the century. The youth cult, which was after all a cult strengthened by the war, and if you remember what I said, by the myth of the war experience. And finally, they were greatly influenced by the idea of camaraderie, that longing for community, which you have in the revolt of the end of the century, and which you have strengthened in the First World War through the community of the trenches, and whose heritage the fascists will eventually take up. So let me say that fascism was a revolution of the radical right. This is of course true in its distinction to conservatism and reaction, which is, as you will see in your reading, very clear and very strong. In the urge to revolution, and a real revolution, which they thought was involved, certainly in Italy to a very large extent at first, in Germany at first too, to a large extent. But as you will read, it is a revolution, but it isn't what we call these days, for some reason unknown to me, the good revolution. Historians make a distinction between a good revolution, which is the Marxist revolution, and a bad revolution, which is every other revolution. Yeah. Well, that shows you something of the trendiness of historians, rather than of historical reality. But in reality, of course, fascism is as much a revolution as a Marxist revolution, and in the last resort, of course, more successful. Because all that happened to Bolshevism, it became another nationalism. But you might say, at least, as I come back to Italian fascism, made room for avant-garde, made a kind of alliance with avant-garde, which Bolshevism never made after its initial phase, which we talked about. So, then it was a revolution, not an economic or social revolution, though we must be very careful. It was a social revolution. It wasn't an economic revolution. It was a social revolution. But it didn't abolish hierarchy. We are apt to judge revolutions by a very stupid criteria, whether it abolishes hierarchy. No revolution abolishes hierarchy, whether the French Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution, and they immediately have to institute new hierarchies. And you're aware of that. New hierarchy. Well, from that point of view, the fascists did institute new hierarchies. The old hierarchies were replaced by new hierarchies. That's very much the same thing that you have in the French Revolution, the same thing that you have in the Bolshevik Revolution. Except here, the rhetoric was not the rhetoric of equality, but a rhetoric of the hierarchy of function, and not the hierarchy of state. That is to say, the rhetoric is different. The fact is the same, and the rhetoric is different. The rhetoric says, in other words, we are a hierarchy, but we must be a hierarchy. There must be leadership. But we are all the same. We are all the same. And that is, of course, symbolized by the uniform, that was symbolized by the fact that, let us say, the janitor in the party could be the superior in the party of the industrialist. The janitor in the chief German industrialist building could be in the party a much higher rank and a much higher influence than the industrialists, in theory. Come back to the practice in a minute. But in theory, it's the same thing. So what you have, therefore, it is a revolution. Hierarchies were new. This is what was so much condemned. At the beginning, both Mussolini and Hitler were condemned for putting into power untested men, men from petty bourgeois background, men from backgrounds who had not been of the ruling classes. If you read the anti-fascist literature at first, that's what the Nazis in fact were condemned for a great deal, for the dictatorship of the janitor. That was one of the most famous anti-Nazi tracts, was called the dictatorship of the janitor. Because indeed, hierarchies were actually replaced. Nor can we say anymore, as we used to, with such great facility, that fascism was against modernism. That, of course, is utterly untrue. Whatever modernism means, it's a dreadful word, a word you should never use. It's a slogan like fascism, or anything becomes a slogan today, almost everything you use. So you mustn't use it, because modernism today doesn't mean anything. It means being vaguely in favor of the third world. Well, who's against mother? Nobody but me. So what you have, therefore, is don't use it. But fascism was a state of industrialization. That's really what it meant. Of large-scale industry. Not only through its rearmament, which in Italy was much less important than in Germany. In fact, in 1939, Italy was very poorly armed. Not only rearmament, but it was, in fact, a stage on the road of modernism, which, like all modernism, is always disguised. Now, this may be clear from all of you that you've done. I really don't know any theory, perhaps the Bauhaus comes nearest to it, which accepts the machine without disguising. Without having a mediation between man and the machine. That just doesn't really exist. There isn't a theory that says the machine is good. That's glorifying the machine. Marx came nearest to it, by the way. But even later, Marxists disguised it in various ways. And the way you disguise it always, the mediation, is a cultural mediation. The machine is made into a friendly instrument. It's placed in the garden, if you like, the machine in the garden. It is mediated by concern for the workplace, air and light, the factory in the garden, all of it, part of the whole garden city movement at the end of the 19th century, part of the whole movement of the 19th century, of modernizing cities, the garden city movement, started in England. First garden city was Hampstead Garden Suburb in London, still exists. Hampstead Garden Suburb, but then there were many others. This whole idea that the machine is there. And that has to do with something I lectured on before, and I want to repeat, with the communications revolution. The communications revolution has to be mediated. And I remind you of something that we talked about at the very beginning of this course. That the communication revolution has to be mediated. Nobody likes to be on a merry-go-round all the time. You have to be able to get off. And you get off by various ways, which we've all discussed before. You get off through expressionist poetry. You get off through romanticism or neo-romanticism. You get off through nationalism, in a sense. You get off through the revolt of youth. You can get off in many ways, but you got to get off. Now, what happened in fascism is that the disguise was more pronounced. It was, in a sense, more pronounced. The mediations were through nationalism, through romanticism. And they came in Italy, in Germany more than Italy, through a program called The Beauty of Work, a very important program, by which industrialists got tax deductions if they beautified their factories. And what that meant, actually, was sanitation, clean toilets, clean workplace, lighted air, all the things that Sweden is doing now. The stopping or the changing of the, what you call it, the ban, you know, what you call it, which Ford invented. The changing of the assembly line, all of it. Together with plants and flowers, with large windows and sunlight, together with work breaks, together with, of course, the organization of workers' leisure time. So what you have is a very successful, and it was tremendously successful, disguising of the machine by putting the machine not only in the garden, but by improving working conditions, and improving working conditions radically. An example for all of Europe, more in Germany than in Italy, improving them at the same time, and I want to mention that now, that economically, National Socialism proved to be flexible. They nationalized. When it came to nationalizing steel, they carried through one of the largest nationalizing of industry in Europe, the so-called Hermann Göring Works. Now they're called the Salzgitter Works. Steel is still nationalized in Germany. Because the Nazis nationalized it. It was never denationalized. And then, of course, all the large party industries, the industries of the SS, like Volkswagen. Volkswagen was an SS industry, chiefly produced by concentration camp labor. Some of you come back to that a little later. But it is SS industry. In other words, the Nazis had a very important public sector of industry. And the private sector of industry was rigidly controlled by them, always the primacy of the party of Nazi aims dominated the economic program. And of course, large industry knuckled under very reluctantly. It had never supported the Nazis at all. Nazis got hardly any money from large industry and its own party, the Conservatives, not the National Socialists. But as large industry did in Italy and in Germany, eventually it arranged itself. And some rather stupid historians have believed that that arrangement means complicity. It doesn't, because we now know how the Nazis were financed. That's no secret and public knowledge now. And of course, industry always knuckles under to the going government. What else are they going to do? But they worked very hard to get the militarists and conservatives to victory. They had a very great suspicion of the Nazis and of the Nazi revolution. But that didn't mean that the Nazis did not modernize, as they did. Here again you have something summarized that we've talked about. The speed of time, the new industry is embodied in what they call the beauty of work. The result was that the workers' life was organized. Now you call it paternalism. That's a value judgment. Workers like paternalism, useful. Paternalism is successful in England and in Germany and Italy, wherever it's been tried. But what was most successful was, of course, what they took over from Italian fascism. Namely, the idea of the fascists, which comes from the syndicate. It comes from trade union sources, which joined the fascists. I'll come to that next time. It comes to syndicalists. And the idea that the worker should have access to all culture. And as a result, you get the founding in Italy of Dopo Lavoro, that means the workers' organization. And in Germany, Kraft durch Freude, which you may have heard about, strength through joy. Now, what these things did, Dopo Lavoro and strength through joy, they gave the workers access to culture in several interesting ways. And remember, this is a program that came from the syndicates, from the left-wing trade unionists who joined fascism in Italy, for reasons I'll come back to, and which the Nazis took over. In several ways, again. And here again, it is this disguising of the machine in several ways. First of all, playgroups came to the factory, that was quite concert, playgroup, guerrilla theater in the factory. Nazi guerrilla theater, obviously. And second of all, what you all know about the Nazi workers going to the opera, to the theater, and above all, travel. Went through joy for workers to travel all over the world. They had their old ocean ships, cruises, travels, to the astonishment of everybody who saw German workers and their wives in the Canary Islands and everywhere else. That was huge. Now, the point I make here is this, and that is that again, when we say it summarizes what we've done, we must come into the fault, which even I fell into at times, of thinking that National Socialism is anti-modern. The anti-modern rhetoric is there, back to the Aryan past. The furthering of the peasants. A peasant couldn't, there was no debt for the peasants. The Nazis made it so that peasants couldn't fall into debt. That was there, this kind of nationalism, that the rulers of the nations are the peasants. That was made reality in peasant legislation. A peasant couldn't sell his inherited farm, yes? And a peasant couldn't be indicted. A peasant
peasant couldn't be indicted for debt. All bets that a peasant got in debt, the government got him out of debt. That you have that whole legislation for what is called hereditary peasant farms. It only applied to peasant farms which were hereditary. And there you can see the Nazi idea that the root of the race is the peasant. The root of the race, the strength of the race is the peasant, and he must be preserved. Well, that's not the difference, you know, from Mr. Karl or Senator Praxmire. We are paying all these much money to preserve the totally uneconomical family farm. The reason that's totally economic, uneconomical, and the only reason the family farm is preserved is because there's an idea working on the land is good, virtue. It's the roots. This is not so unknown to America or any country. It's a reaction to modernity that you have everywhere. Don't destroy the family farm. Why? Working on the land is good. Well, it comes in the 18th century. Sir, I think to be more virtuous to live in fortune, you lick the table. I don't see that. Where is this hero? Yes. In other words, work on the land isn't very good. I mean, it's an absurd idea, isn't it? Working on the land. I was made as a youth to pick the table, to build my character. You know? So, in other words, what you have there here is clear. You have a kind of idea that goes into all nationalism. But again, with the Nazis and with the Italian fascists, it becomes an exaggeration. It's really made sort of in the center. That's really it. It becomes more exaggerated, really in the center. But you have it everywhere, and it is legislated. It is legislated. Now, what you have here, therefore, then, is the machine in the garden. This idea of modernism, modernism disguised, but modernism more disguised, if you like, than in anywhere else. To summarize this point before I come to questions, is, first of all then, the first point I want to make about all of fascism is that fascism summarizes what we have to do. It is connected with mediation and successful mediation. Mediation, which in a way grasps better than the left ever did, the nature of modern mass politics and the nature of modern mass industry. Because the left, with its rationalism, always had an idea: we must accept that, we must accept the factory, we must accept the industrialism, we must accept urban life. But here you have it disguised, you have it mediated. You have, if you like, the factory in the garden, all of that sort of thing, which was a great success. And these mediations are, of course, mediations that, in the last resort, depend on emotion rather than reason. That must be clear, but whose consequence was a huge step in modernization. Nobody would doubt that Italy and Germany was modernized to fashion. Largely because two reasons. First of all, large-scale nationalization in Germany especially, and emphasis on large-scale industry, an emphasis which betrayed, of course, the people who had voted for the Nazis. That is to say, the little shopkeeper. But the little shopkeeper has always been betrayed, for very obvious reasons. That as things get more monopoly capitalistic one way or another, this goes from socialist countries to another, large-scale capitalism, there isn't really a room for it. It's difficult to have a room. So, they were betrayed. The peasants were not betrayed. And, of course, industry was, in a way, through that throughout. But the second way is the improvement of the workplace and the improvement of work conditions. Very rapid. And if you put into this the second thing I want to talk about, nothing else, the second thing, namely the real situation, which is usually hoped to God, the real situation, how fascism grew up, and its successes, then again you will see what I mean. The great economic successes, the astounding economic successes, Mussolini kept Italy out of the depression, out of the economic depression, an astounding economic depression. No other nation in Europe could say the same. Obviously, even people who wouldn't agree with fascism would have been inclined towards fascism or something like that. And Hitler did something even more astonishing. That in 1 year, he got rid of 6 million unemployed. And otherwise, then the legend, he didn't do it only by rearmament. He did it very much as Roosevelt will do it later, by public works spending, deficit spending, public works, and of course, ordinary industrial investment as well. So these are successes that I think you must not forget, that people who had pro-Nazi or pro-fascism, when you saw this change, this is a change you could see with your own eyes in Germany. First you had all these unemployed, you know, begging in the street, criminality. And in 1 year, gone, there's a new spirit in the land. And again, you may say this is cosmetic. But what isn't cosmetic? Everything is cosmetic. It was a cosmetic which, sure, led him to war, not in Italy. Mussolini didn't need it. In Germany, Hitler's ambition. It was, of course, tied to Hitler's ambitions at war. It was cosmetic, but it was a cosmetic of enormous and startling success. For one, we must not forget that all of this, the mediation and the success of fascism, took place in the real world and took place to meet real problems, real and existing problems. And that, in a sense, fascism is the child of how it grew up, that is to say, of the actual situation. I would put it this way, that the strength of fascism was that it somehow knew how to take advantage of the actual situation. More in Italy than in Germany. For in Germany, you must say, fascism is Hitler. In Italy, it isn't. In fact, it's ridiculous to use fascism for Germany. Never read a book that has fascism for Germany in the title. It will be a primitive Marxist work of no importance whatsoever, except as a virtue trip for the young German to write. What you have, therefore, here is, it isn't the same. It isn't the same in this sense, to begin with. That in Italian fascism, you must make a distinction between fascism and Mussolini. Fascism grew up at first almost independent of Mussolini. I'll come back to that, because it's a term in Italian, fascism. But in Germany, undoubtedly, fascism is Hitler. Now you can say this, that even in Italy, fascism without Mussolini, which was largely an agrarian movement of centrism, fascism without Mussolini might never have gotten anywhere if Mussolini hadn't taken hold of it. This is true. And you must say that, in a sense, it's a matter almost of accident that the fascist movements of Europe have two leaders of genius. That is to say, two leaders who had what no European leader had since Bismarck. Bismarck had the same thing. The two things it takes to be a genius. Policy. The first thing is time, political time. And the second is compromise without losing sight of your end. Compromise that you will know is temporary compromise. Compromise that you made, but you make it transparent without the end. That is to say, a kind of way of fooling people, a kind of way of fooling people because you have an end. That's much more clear for Hitler than Mussolini. Mussolini was a man of the world. Mussolini was an ordinary statesman in many ways. And nobody would say that Hitler was an ordinary statesman. But look at the way he proceeded once in power. He always said this is my last demand, and everybody believed him, quite often. When he occupied the Rhineland, he said it's my last demand, and everybody believed him, because that's how international relations were conducted. When he first the Nuremberg laws against the Jews, he said that's my last demand, and 6,000 Jews came back to live in Germany, because with the Nuremberg laws you could live. All the Nuremberg laws said you couldn't hire Aryan maids. Aryan maids, and you couldn't fly the swastika, and that wasn't, you could live with that as a Jew, yes. And so 6,000 Jews came back to Germany because Hitler said that is my last demand. But because we know it wasn't his last demand, but that's the way he operated, an operation of genius. He confused it, realizing again of the working of modern politics. He had a very good sense of human relations, very odd, that this man, who was a fanatic, he was an Ayatollah Khomeini in every sense of the word, but he kept his fanaticism to himself. That was his genius. Unlike Khomeini, he was a genius. He kept his fanaticism to himself, and instead he maneuvered through excellent timing. Remember that Hitler's invasion of other countries were on the weekend, when the British Foreign Office was at their country house. Hitler always invaded in March, a weekend in March, always, because the British Foreign Office was gone. He was already there. And he had the advantage of at least a day's advantage. That's how he operated. But he never lost sight of his goal. And indeed, eventually, when he set his goal, this has been reigniting, nobody believed it. In other words, what was his goal? His goal was the extermination of the Jews. And the only one he declared war on when the Jews, he never declared war on anything but the Jews. But when he declared war on the Jews in 1939, nobody really believed him. So, then I would say this, that Hitler more than Mussolini in this sense was the master of what is at the basis of fascism, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, that is mastery, because that's what the modern world is about. You make a prophecy, then you fulfill it. And Hitler made it most clearly about the Jews. He said, if the Jews start the Second World War, I'll eliminate it. And everybody said, yes, because it's bad to start another war. I mean, they deserve it. So Hitler started another war and eliminated it. But he did that all along. That he did it in politics. He said, you know, if the other parties would do that, then he got them to do it. And then, oh yes. So in other words, he carried people along. And therefore he was serious. You see, you must understand, after all, if you know about modern politics, that in a sense, a phenomenon like you have in Iran today is not really a serious phenomenon in the long run. Can't run a modern nation by fanatics. Hitler was a serious fanatic. In modern times, at least in industrialized nations, the only fanatics who have to be taken seriously are the fanatics who know how to disguise it, how to bind their ties, how to confuse the opposition, and who in the end start a war in which they can do it. Because there is no doubt that Hitler started the war because he realized very largely that you needed large open spaces away from Germany to kill the Jews. You couldn't kill it in Germany. Euthanasia had been a failure because you killed the insane right in Germany, and in the end little boys had been running after the trucks and said they're going auntie and things like that, and that wasn't very good publicity. So you couldn't really kill masses of people in Germany. The Germans wouldn't stand. So you needed large empty spaces. You see, Hitler learned his lesson. He learned his lesson from his putsch, that you must come to power legally. He learned his lesson here too, that you can't exterminate people in Germany. You've got to find a place to exterminate them, which is, in a way, large open spaces far away from the Germans. And that was Poland, of course. And, as you know, there were very strict punishments for reporting back what happened in Poland. So, in other words, he learned his lesson. So maybe that's another thing. You need people who learn their lesson. Now, you can call this unscrupulous. And I think with Mussolini it was unscrupulous. And the difference between Hitler and Mussolini is very difficult. Mussolini became in the end a cynic, a complete cynic about the Italian people, a cynic about Hitler, a cynic about everything, a complete cynic. You would have loved to spend an evening with Mussolini in the end, because he was cynical about just about everything. But Hitler kept the Second World War going. Why did Hitler keep the war going? There's evidence Hitler knew the war was lost a year before. I tell you why Hitler kept the war going. To kill as many Jews as possible. That's why he kept the war going. He was willing to sacrifice as many Germans as possible to kill as many Jews as possible. That's really what he did. Sacrifice as many Germans. It's possible to kill as many Jews as possible. And then you come into an order of magnitude, which is an order of magnitude quite different. Of course, what you have here, the city, Mussolini. That is to say, Hitler always knew what he wanted, probably from his days in Vienna. There's a controversy about it, which he has reflected in your reading, when he first believed it. But I am inclined to believe myself. From his time in Vienna, he believed in a racism, which was an outrageous racism. Nobody believed it. We wouldn't even write about it. We wouldn't even teach about these marginal races, these theosophical races. The main racism is the eugenics movement. That is perfectly respectable, or imperial racism. Yes? But Hitler, unfortunately, came to believe in a fringe race. In a fringe race, not in the greatest screwball. And the whole question is always, people always ask me, you know, authority on the subject, what do we know about Nazis today? And when they ask me, like the Jews of Milwaukee, I said, you stop questioning and you beat them up. Then you go away. That's what you better do. But the question is, of course, of fascism, or of Hitler. How does a fringe come to the center? And that you must never forget is the question that you must ask in all your reading. Because the whole phenomenon of the Holocaust or what happened is due to this one fact. How did this utter screwball, with a racism that nobody would take seriously, believe me, come to the center? That's the question. In other words, when you look, you always look in America at Nazis. The Nazis in America, totally unimportant. The States Rights Party, they all came to my lecture in Atlanta. I had quite a good time with them in the sense they came in uniform. Yeah, well, never mind. The National States Rights Party came seriously. These Nazis, no. What is important is when they begin to move to the center. That you'll notice soon enough. When this movement starts and why they can move to the center. And that is perhaps the central idea. What you have in the triumph of fascism is really a combination of two things. Of the genius of Hitler and Mussolini. There is no doubt in Italy, I say, are somewhat less important. And at the same time, what enables them to move to the center? Well, I think there are several things which enable them in that historical situation to move to the center. First of all, the First World War and defeat. Defeat is important, and Italy thought itself to be defeat. Secondly, economic collapse. Italy and Germany were in a state of economic collapse. Who would deny that? Thirdly, a state of near civil war. I mean, after all, before Mussolini came to power, there was civil war against the workers, against the industrial, the peasants against the landowners. Mussolini sided with the industrialists and the landowners. It's not quite that easy. And after all, in Germany, before Hitler came to power, there was civil war in Prussia. I think there were about 10,000 dead in 3 years. That is civil. There was civil war. So second of all, you need all of the war, you need civil economic collapse. You need a state of civil war. And fascism encouraged the state of civil war. In immediate terms, fascism is a solution to civil war that you get into the state of civil war. and falsely or whatever, I would say, it is also social collapse in the sense that the social hierarchies have become tenuous, that there is a great longing for community, a longing for change. So that you have a coincidence of four things, and they all coincide at the same time. I don't think it would have been any good if one had come after the other. They all coincide at the same time. What coincides at the same time is the love of war, economic collapse, social collapse in civil war. And they all coincide. They all coincide. Fifthly, it had a tradition. Because in such a coinciding, you could become Bolshevik. Why didn't they become Bolshevik? On the left, there was already a tradition, the tradition of anti-parliamentary government, the tradition of the anti-bourgeois-bourgeois revolution, which I've talked about already. There were these two traditions. But sixthly, and really firstly, in a sense, they came to power legally. I dare say if there's been a chance for Bolshevism to come to power legally in Italy, that might have been possible, not in Germany. But fascism came to power as illegal government, an illegal way out, as a constitutional way out. And therefore it carried the middle class. It could be two things at the same time, a law and order party and a party for change. The great thing about fascism, which Bolshevism never had, you could always in fascism eat your cake and have it. But you could never have that in Bolshevism, never. In fascism you can eat your cake and have it as well. So, you have that here very clearly. It was a law and order party. It obviously was a law and order party, but also a party of change. It came legally. It never was a matter of party. To who would oppose it? There was no opposition. Fascism came to power where it came to power without opposition. Where it did not come to power in Europe, it had. That's very important. Let me put it another way. I think it's in my conversation. Everywhere where fascism came to power, the state dropped into its arms like a ripe fruit, like an overripe fruit. It never really had to fight. It dropped like an overripe fruit. And wherever it had to fight, it actually did not succeed. Wherever it had to fight, it may have come near, but it never succeeded. Not even in Eastern Europe, where it was the workers' party. Remember, in Eastern Europe, where there were no Marxist paper parties, it's fascism that mobilized the workers. In Hungary, in Romania, the fascist parties mobilized the workers. Marxist parties were forbidden. There were fascists mobilized the masses. And even so, in none of those countries did they come to power. I think that's not an uninteresting realization, that fascism came to power when the old system was ripe to collapse. So that the question in 1924, when Mussolini became prime minister, 22, when Mussolini became prime minister, and in 1934, was a different question. It wasn't a question who will win the fight. That was never the question. The question was, in whose arms will the system collapse? Who will be there to catch? That was the question, yeah? And obviously a movement that was cross-class, that had a consensus support, was better positioned to catch the existing society than a movement that was only geared to one class, the proletariat, to which most people didn't want to belong in the first place. So it's quite clear that fascism at that moment was much better positioned than the proletariat, to which very few really wanted to belong. And that you can see very simply in another thing, that communism and socialism vanished like the driven snow. Either Italy or Germany, was there any significant resistance from those groups? None whatsoever. There was resistance in Italy, but the Italian anti-fascist resistance was liberal, and intellect. There's now a big scandal in Italy because a member of the Italian Fiducio of the Communist Party in the fellow interview, you're reading the Nazis, there's a fellow interview with Amendola, Giovanni Amendola, of the Communist Party of Italy, who now says, oh yes, well, all this communist resistance to fascism is largely a legend. It has to be. Many have many good things to say about Italy. And there was even a very good commerce for a while between Lenin and Mussolini. No, no. There was the anti-fascist resistance in Italy, which was lively. In Germany, there was no resistance. Come today, in Italy, the lively anti-fascist resistance was a liberal intellectual, and not at first, at any rate, by communists. Only much later, because there was a kind of mutual admiration society of Mussolini and Lenin at first, which is today often forgotten. I think it should not be forgotten because it's important in this regard. So what you have there, communism, you must ask yourself, what is the weakness of Marxism? What is the weakness of socialism if it could not stand up as fascism? It always seemed to me almost incredible to believe that people today could still believe in socialism and communism, which failed so miserably in Italy and Germany. So miserable. That's a great weakness. So you have, in a way, to discuss the weakness of this, the kind of thing. Now, from there, and I will stop at the beginning of next time. From then, I think it is time, from these general remarks, to make more specific remarks, namely the specific remarks for a minute, why Italian fascism, and above all, culture. The next time, above all, I want to make some remarks about culture, both as far as the cultural picture of Nazi Germany is concerned, which you know, and above all, the cultural picture of Italy. And here I want to say something for 1 minute of those who heard the paper I gave earlier on avant-garde and fascism. That's been in some other tradition. So anyway, we shall do that the next time, and I want questions.